It's the right thing to do because it's about who owns football. It doesn't belong to FIFA. It doesn't belong to the executive committee members of FIFA. It doesn't belong to those who run it in any particular country. It is the sport for all of us.
Herzlich willkommen zurück zu Football for Future, der Sonderausgabe zur Weltmeisterschaft 2022 in Katar. Noch nie wurden so viele Themen diskutiert, die mit Fußball nichts zu tun haben. Es geht um Korruption und es geht um Menschenrechte. Wie konnte es eigentlich passieren, dass das größte Sportereignis der Welt in einem kleinen Wüstenstaat stattfindet? Dieser Frage werden wir nachgehen und natürlich noch vielen anderen Fragen. Die Gäste sind besonders spannend. Sie haben sich zusammengefunden für die ProSieben-Doku Das Milliardenspiel, die am 7.11. auf ProSieben ausgestrahlt worden ist und noch heute in der Mediathek zu finden ist. In der Doku sind die Interviews natürlich nur mit kleinen Ausschnitten gezeigt und mit freundlicher Unterstützung von ProSieben ist es uns gelungen, in diesem Podcast nun alle Interviews in voller Länge zu zeigen. Heute geht es los mit Bonita Merciades, ein ganz besonderer Gast. Sie hat 2010 selbst versucht, die Weltmeisterschaft ins eigene Land zu holen und zwar nach Australien. In ihrem Buch Whatever It Takes hat sie ausgepackt über die internen Prozesse bei der FIFA im Rahmen eines Vergabeprozesses und darüber will ich mit ihr reden. Haltet euch also fest und macht euch gefasst auf ein paar schockierende Insider-Informationen über die FIFA und die Machenschaften im Rahmen einer Vergabe. Viel Spaß mit Bonita Merciades.
Hello Bonita.
Hi Benjamin.
Very nice that you made your way here.
Thank you, it's lovely to be here.
Maybe to start off, I mean I read your book, I know many things about you now, but maybe the people who watch, not everybody knows you, so maybe you can start introducing yourself really quick.
I've been involved in football my entire life. I grew up with it as a kid, played it badly, have been a volunteer for various clubs and a soccer mum and all of those sorts of things. And to this day, I'm still a volunteer with a local football club and with local football organisations. And then just by chance, I got involved in it professionally, working in it, and both as the team operations manager for the men's national team, the Socceroos, and also later on as head of corporate and public affairs at Football Australia.
Life for football, sounds like it. Yeah. What is your love for football? Why do you have such a big heart for that sport?
Oh, in a sense, it's something I grew up with. It was part of the family culture, and I think that's an important point. But also, I love the politics of it. I love the fact that football is the one sport that can bring the world, potentially can bring the world together. And sport is an important part of society, and sport should show an example for a society of how we should live our lives. And that's what I love about it.
More particularly, we want to focus on one aspect of your professional life, and that was your involvement in the Australian bid for the World Cup 2018 and 2022. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit about your role in the Australian bid back in the days.
Yeah, I was head of corporate and public affairs for Football Australia itself, and when we decided to bid, I also had to take responsibility for the same sorts of measures, issues, for the 2018 and 2022 bid. So that included communications, media, marketing, public relations, aspects of government relations, those sorts of things. So it was right across the full sort of aspects of every part of the bid.
And how was your feeling about being part of that bid? Was that your lifetime goal or...
No.
How did it come about?
No, it wasn't my lifetime goal to work on a World Cup bid. In fact, I was very reluctant to do so and told my boss at the time, the chief executive and the chairman, that I didn't want to work on the bid. It came about because I was there in the position. I knew football, unlike a lot of people in the organisation at the time, I knew football really well in Australia. I knew its history. I had, a strategic mind about where we should be going. So it was just part of my role, I guess. It just metamorphosed into being a much broader role. I didn't want to work on the bid because I always thought that anything involving FIFA was not something that was going to be based on merit. And I didn't think we should get involved in a process like that.
So in general, you were against the whole Australian bid, and you wouldn't have advised Australia to actually go into that bid in general?
I think you'd have to be really certain of the processes that were to be followed and the environment in which a decision is being made. And FIFA at that time, and we're talking now 2008, so it's 14 years ago, the reputation of it wasn't good. It was known that it worked as an organisation run by fear or favour. There were deals, there were counter deals, there were double deals. And if you bring that environment into a bidding process, especially when there are two World Cup tournaments up for grabs in one vote, it was a recipe for, well, corruption at worst, but certainly dodgy deals at best.
Who was the driving force within the Australian Football Association to finally do the bid, go ahead and try to make the deal?
Our chairman was the driving force. He was very keen for it. And, you know, from a strategic point of view, it was a good thing. We needed to turbo boost our sport. We, still to this day, but also then, we were seen as the number three or four football code in our country. We play lots of sport in Australia. And we were the number three or four football code. And this was seen as a way of catapulting us into a sort of a different stratosphere in terms of it being a popular sport. We were already popular in terms of participation, but this was a way of bringing the game to the attention of the rest of the Australian population, as well as being good for the country. Because, you know, countries like to bid for these major world tournaments as well.
You are not in the team alone, obviously. So maybe you can explain a little bit, what did the team look like? Who else was part of the core bidding team?
Well, we had a few staff members, of course, and that was led by the chief executive at the time. But we also had three international consultants who were seen as being the absolute key and important members of our team. We were told that if we took them on board and had them as consultants, we would win the World Cup because they knew how to do so. They had won Germany 2006, they had won South Africa 2010. They had experience, they had expertise, and between them they had very close relationships with a number of executive committee members.
Well, who were the people advising you that you need these consultants to win the World Cup?
A number of people, including the consultants themselves.
Who literally,
one of them came to Sydney one time and said, if you employ me, I will bring Franz Beckenbauer with me and we will win you the World Cup. Literally. He stood in front of me and said that. But also, you know, Sepp Blatter, Mohammed bin Hamman, a member of the ethics committee at the time who was a prominent broadcaster in Australia, they all said, employ these people and you will win the World Cup.
You're talking about international consultants. For us, obviously, it's also interesting they were not only international, but they're predominantly Germans.
Yes, two of them were German and one of them was a Swiss-Hungarian.
How come the Germans are so well connected and powerful in this whole game?
Well, I guess that's a question for Germany. But, you know, the trio, but particularly the two Germans, had experience in winning the 2006 World Cup, the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. They had, one of them in particular, had worked with Sepp Blatter from the very early days when Horst Dassler was involved with Adidas. So they had a long history together.
So we talk about Mr. Radmann in that case.
Yes.
Who was, where it's well known that he's very trusted with Franz Beckenbauer, who was an ExCo member at that time, or not yet?
No, he was an ExCo member at that time, yes.
So involving Mr. Radmann also meant that you have Franz Beckenbauer on board, and also maybe the vote of Franz Beckenbauer on board.
Yes, and that was the expectation, that we would go into the vote and have Franz Beckenbauer's vote and Reinald Tamari's vote.
How did you compensate them? I mean, what was the amount of money you needed to pay? Obviously, they were not volunteering for the Australian bid, I guess.
No, they certainly didn't volunteer. And between the three of them, they got around 15 million Australian dollars for their work, which ended up with one vote. And included in that was even payments of a bonus, which was supposed to be paid because we won, but they still got paid that bonus.
Well, how can you pay a bonus for winning if you end up having one vote at the end? How does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense. And that was one of the things that, you know, at the end of the whole bidding process and when reports had to go in from our perspective to government because we're talking about taxpayers' money, that detail was glossed over. But in terms of the internal management reporting we had for our bid, there was amounts set aside for bonuses. And in respect of Mr. Radman and Mr. Arbold, that bonus was paid.
Did the public in Australia never ask questions about that? Where did you put the money, even though you didn't win at the end?
There was very little interest in following up on that. I was probably alone almost in Australia from even raising these issues. And I think the view was, let's just put it all behind us, pretend it didn't happen. And we're also dealing with a man who was one of the most powerful men, or probably is still one of the most powerful men in the country. And from a political perspective, from government perspective, neither major political party wanted to upset him.
To put this a little bit in perspective, these $15 million, what was the time frame the consultants were working for that amount of money? So how much did they get on a monthly basis, for example?
They were working for us for approximately 2 years, just a little bit under 2 years. So, for instance, the amount of money that Fedor Radman received under his main contract was approximately $150,000 a month.
To put it even more in perspective and compare it to the United States, who were also bidding, I think these $15 million you paid for the three consultants was more money than the whole American bid was all about. Have you been just a little bit naive? Why did you spend so much money if you compare it also to others who never spent that amount?
I think it would be wrong to characterise the Australian bid as naive. I think that we went into it with our eyes wide open about what was required to win a World Cup bid at that time. And so the amounts of money paid to the international consultants and the amounts of money paid to the Asian Football Confederation and the Oceania Football Confederation and Jack Warner and potentially to Africans was all part of what was seen as whatever it takes to win this World Cup bid.
What was the overall amount Australia was spending for that bid, even though you were not winning at the end?
Around $50 million, $50 million.
There was a small aspect dealing with these consultants where they said, you need to have celebrities, you need to have good-looking female celebrities. Why was it so important to get Nicole Kidman, Kylie Minogue or other females into the bid being your ambassador?
Because the 24 voters were old men. Simple as that.
I read in your book that one of the consultants even advised to contact Harvey Weinstein, who later on was just the beginning of the whole Me Too movement. And he advised you to contact him to get these women on board. Is that true?
Particularly one of them, yes. It was around the time of the draw for the 2010 World Cup that was being held in Cape Town in 2009. All of the bid teams had to be in Cape Town to present their bid internationally for the first time. And we looked around, we didn't have a David Beckham, we didn't have a Luis Figo, we didn't have any, you know, big-name players who could come along.
Zinedine Zidane with Qatar back in the days?
Exactly, because he's a Qatari now. But we didn't have anyone like that we could bring on board. So the consultant said, well, you do have Nicole Kidman, you do have Kylie Minogue, you do have Cate Blanchett, so how about some of those? And at the time, one of those actresses had just finished a film for Harvey Weinstein, and one of our consultants said, well, I know Harvey Weinstein, so I'll get him to get this person to come along to Cape Town. It didn't happen, but Harvey Weinstein was contacted.
So when was the first time when your expectations basically turned out to be true? When was the first time you've been in touch with something that smelled like dodgy.
The moment when it was clear that it was dodgy was when Reynal Tamari, who was then the executive committee member of FIFA from Oceania, came to Sydney and had a list of requirements that he asked us to fulfil in order to get his vote. That list of requirements, he came to a meeting, it was on a piece of paper. I always remember it was folded in two and it had Times New Roman font on it. And it had about 11 or 12 items on it in which he wanted us to deliver on all of those issues. I remember my boss showing it to me and he said, you're never to copy this. You're not to write it down. You have to memorise it. And we've got to deliver on all of these and you have never seen this piece of paper. And, you know, when you're told you haven't seen a piece of paper when the piece of paper is sitting in front of you with typewriting on it, you sort of think this isn't right. On that list were things such as Hyundai vehicles for each of the member associations in Oceania. There was support for the director of coaching, which we had already been giving anyway. There was a conference that they wanted to have in Auckland. There was support for a new administrative building in Auckland for the Oceania Confederation. So there was a range of things such as that which they expected us to deliver on.
And how did you react upon it? What did you do with that list?
We were told it was our highest priority to make sure those requirements were met. And in fact, we went to government and sought more money to fulfill those demands. And in the end, government gave it to us.
How much money did you spend on that piece of paper for Oceania?
At least $4 million. That was what was received by Oceania as part of the grant, which was done under our foreign aid budget. And you know, from an Australian perspective, providing foreign aid in the Pacific is a priority. It was a priority then and it's a priority now. But this was foreign aid that was specifically to getting more sport into some of those countries as well as building a new headquarters building.
And was it made clear that if you are paying for that piece of paper, you get the vote from Reinhard Tamari? Was that connection clearly made and transparent?
Absolutely. That was understood from the outset, that if we could fulfil this list of demands, we would go into the whole voting process with Reinhard Tamari's vote. And this was before we had even formally indicated that we were bidding, although it had been informally talked about in the media and elsewhere for some time. I also remember making a joke with my boss that if it was going to cost us $4 million for every vote, it was going to cost us $52 million because we needed 13 votes to win. And, you know, we laughed about that at the time, but there was a truth to it.
Well, you ended up paying $50 million at the end. So actually the joke was coming reality at the end.
Exactly, yes.
So, but I mean, the funny thing about it on top of that was that Reinhard Tamari got suspended just before he was able to give his vote. So at the end, you paid that money without even getting that vote.
That's correct. He was suspended because he was caught on camera offering his vote to supposed consultants on behalf of another bid. And he then wanted to clear his name. So in the end, Oceania didn't get a vote at all, so we didn't get a vote from them.
Did anybody follow up if the money which was going to Oceania was actually used for the purpose which was intended or was written on the piece of paper?
Yeah, certainly in terms of the major amount of cash, the $4 million, that was followed up, and it was followed up by government process because it was an additional amount of money that was part of the foreign aid budget. So that happened.
So we jump a little bit in the process. Later, you met all the other bidders for the first time in Zurich. What was that meeting all about?
That was one of the compulsory bid meetings that FIFA called all bidders to. The idea was that we would come to Zurich and hear from key executives within FIFA about different aspects of what they expected from our bids and the tournament. So it included Sepp Blatter, Jerome Valk, the head of commercial, the head of legal, the head of finance. So we had briefings from all of them.
So the meeting was also about the guidelines and the framework of the bid. Was there things which made you curious, which were maybe observations which stood out for you?
I think there were a couple of things that stood out. One, Sepp Blatter said very clearly that he wanted to see the World Cup go to, quote, new lands. Which I thought if you were Japan or South Korea or England, you probably would have been disappointed with that because he made it clear that what he wanted out of it. The number two was, I always remember one of the executives from FIFA said that there couldn't be any more than two stadiums in one city. That was a little bit problematic for us because of the way our rectangular stadiums fall in Australia. But it was really problematic for Qatar because at the time they really only had one city, and that was Doha. We then went into a lunch break, and after the lunch break, which took about an hour and a half or so, the person who was running the bid for FIFA came in and said, oh, we've had a rethink about the issue around two stadiums in one city. If you have to have more than two stadiums in one city, that's okay. Now, I thought to myself straight away, that is very, very effective lobbying from Qatar, because they had that rule change basically on the spot. And then the third bit was around accommodation. There was a question about whether accommodation could be in another country, which of course was also was relevant to a number of the bidders, but certainly not Australia, because we're an island, and certainly not Russia, and certainly not the United States. And it was made clear that you could have accommodation in another country, such as, for instance, Qatar specifically asked if they had used accommodation in the United Arab Emirates, would that be okay? And the answer was yes.
You already mentioned it. The decisive circle of men in that case is the exco of FIFA. Can you explain a little bit what is that committee?
Well, the executive committee at that time comprised the president of FIFA, a number of vice presidents, so the head of each confederation, so that's six vice presidents, and then elected members to the executive committee from each confederation. So all up, there were 24 members. And depending on which confederation it was as to how many members they had on that executive committee. Obviously, at the time, UEFA had the most, Oceania had the least.
Talking about diversity in that committee, how was it put together in general? Have there been any women involved?
At that time in 2010, no, there were no women on the executive committee at all. And I think they would have been horrified to have women on that committee. It just wasn't something that entered the mind of most of them that women should be on decision-making bodies of FIFA.
Quite an amount of members of the Exco later was getting into court cases, allegations and alike. I mean, famous figures like Chuck Blazer, Chuck Warner and others. Can you talk a little bit about the culture in general of these men?
I think the overriding culture within the executive committee and within the upper echelons of FIFA at the time was that they had completely lost touch with what football was about. So it wasn't about what they could do for football, it was what football could do for them. That doesn't apply in every single individual case, of course, but it did in the vast majority. And, you know, from a bidding perspective, that's what the bidders tapped into, was this basically individual greed and wanting things. So how could you satisfy what they wanted? I mean, the bid for 2018 and 2022 was characterised to me at a much later date by the late, great Andrew Jennings, the English investigative journalist, as the greedy old men of FIFA wanting one last payday before they dropped off the perch. And that's sort of humorous, but it also characterises them to a very great deal. And they, as I said, completely lost touch with what the game was all about.
Can you characterise a little bit what it means to lose touch? I mean, they were hosted as queens and kings, but more like kings, actually, when they were traveling, who they met and all of that. You can give a little bit insight about that.
They were treated as if they were the highest levels of government. It was, you know, for instance, Sepp Blatter or an executive committee member of FIFA would visit a country and they would get what is called a green light corridor from the airport, whereas you and me might catch a train or get in a car and stop at traffic lights. They literally get all of the lights turning green as they go through that intersection, for example. Now, that type of reception is something which a head of state gets. And they were very much treated with that sort of VIP status. And they expected it. They went to a football match, and whereas you or I might go in the terraces and sing with the fans or kick around a ball in a park with a kid, they would go to a VVIP. There was a VIP status and VVIP status, very, very important person status. And they would go to that and sit in the best seats in the house, usually in air-conditioned comfort. They would have no interaction with the fans, or it's not really be at a football match feeling the football match or hearing what the players were saying on the field as they were playing. It was all about the drinks and the networking and the food that they could eat. I think it, to the extent that some of them might have come through their country process as a volunteer in the beginning. For instance, Chuck Blazer did. He started as a volunteer, as a soccer dad in America, and came through the process. But they very much lost sight of what grassroots football was all about.
I mean, they met Queen Elizabeth, the Pope, Obama and others, and it was just because they were so powerful.
Absolutely, and governments like to get close to them. I mean, they lost all sense. Politicians tend to lose judgment when they get near a superstar footballer, such as, you know, Lionel Messi or something, but they're the same even with the FIFA executive, and they are treated as one of them. So literally, Sepp Blatter could pick up the phone and talk with Angela Merkel at the time or Barack Obama, and his call would be taken.
You also had to make sure that the ex-co is on your side. So it was common to please them. In what ways did you try to please the ex-co members?
Well, the important thing to win the vote was to please 13 members of the executive committee, so to get the majority. So as a bid, and all bids would have done this, you broke down who was on the executive committee, whether any of them were already allocated to a particular bidder. So, for example, it was never thought that Jack Warner or Chuck Blazer would vote for Australia. They were going to vote for the US because it was in their confederation. And then of those votes that were free, what could you do to convince them that they should vote for your country? And so individually, particularly with international consultants, you would find out what it was that they would like to see, what they would like done, what it took for them to vote for Australia.
So within that process of trying to get them on your side, you were giving them several pleasures and gifts. What was that gifting all about?
I always thought the gifting was a bit silly. We were told by one of our consultants that every time we saw a FIFA executive committee member, we should take them a gift. So, you know, that'd be ridiculous. And yet FIFA had in its guidelines that gifts were supposed to be incidental. There's an interesting relationship between how you and I might describe incidental and how a FIFA executive committee member describes incidental. But we would take them gifts. That was supposed to make a difference. Nonetheless, the gifts were appreciated and they were taken, but at the end of the day, it didn't make any difference whatsoever.
Tell me about the gifts. What did you hand over?
Well, one that is quite a famous incident for the Australian bid, although it was outside the bidding context in some ways, was a pearl necklace for Jack Warner's, or pearl pendant for Jack Warner's wife. A certain part of Australia has very rare South Sea Island pearls. When the FIFA Congress was in Sydney in May 2008, each of the executive committee member wives was given one of these pendants. Jack Warner's wife missed out. Jack Warner pestered us through our consultants for months and months about getting this pendant, and it got to the point of ridiculousness where there was none left in Australia, and we had to go and get it elsewhere in order to deliver him this pendant, which we delivered via our consultants. So to this day, I don't know whether Jack Warner's wife actually received it. But there, you know, there are other things, such as at one stage we bought them all an R.M. Williams kangaroo leather belt, and we literally had to run around Sydney guessing the belt size for all these 24 men. And when it came to Chuck Blazer, for example, there wasn't a belt that was big enough. So,
so we don't know if Chuck Warner's wife ever received her necklace, but we are aware that you never received Chuck Warner's vote, for sure.
Absolutely.
Besides the belts and the pearls, what other gifts were in place and what were the consultants advising you to put in some of these presents?
Another one was, again, a kangaroo leather wallet. And I thought the wallet itself was plenty enough for a gift. But one of our consultants said, oh, no, the wallet also has to have a gold coin in it. I refused to put the gold coin in.
Well, is that, I mean, gifting and gift presents not obvious corruption already on a small scale? Is it within the guidelines?
Yeah, it is within the guidelines to give gifts of incidental value. I guess it comes down to what your definition of incidental value is. I remember making a joke with the same consultant very early on in the bidding process, and he was telling us, you must always take this gift. And I pointed out, but the gift has to be of incidental value. What did you give? And the example he gave was of a Mont Blanc pen. Now, to me, a Mont Blanc pen is not an incidental value. And I made the joke and asked him, did you also give them an Audi car? And I was told to shut up because he didn't get the humour of that. But what became clear was what's incidental to you or me is entirely different to what is incidental to a FIFA executive committee member.
Obviously, it also has to have a certain level in order for them to even feel it still.
Yeah.
Because obviously their level was a little bit higher than maybe our normal level.
Yeah, they would expect something of a higher value than you or I might expect that was incidental. But the other aspect of it from my perspective is, why do we have to give them a gift at all? You know, it's one thing to go to someone's house and be given a meal and you take them a gift to say thank you for this meal. It's another thing to be presenting a case on behalf of your football nation and your country saying why you should vote for us. If that's being considered on its merits and if it's a level playing field, gifts shouldn't come into it, whether it's incidental or a major gift.
I mean, it was an interesting side story where one of the consultants talked to you about the official bits, the official bidding pitch, basically, and that it was actually not so important, was it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of our consultants told us time after time after time that there were three things that you had to get right, and that was the bid book, the technical inspection when the FIFA committee came to your country to have a look at it, and the final presentation. You had to get those right, but none of them counted. And in fact, we were told that none of the executive committee members would ever read the bid book. And I don't blame them because it would be a couple of thousand pages. So the only people who would read through that were those who would be actually paid to do it. But yet, this same consultant was getting a lot of money to be responsible for these three things, which he said had to be right, but had absolutely nothing to do with how the vote went.
So it was actually made clear from the beginning that these official bidding papers don't really count, but what's really counting is how do you please the Exco in different other ways?
Absolutely. It was about how you please the executive committee and how you get 13 out of those 24 voters to vote for you. Having a good bid book and making it look nice was one thing, but what was in it counted for absolutely nothing when it came to the vote.
Besides what we talked about, the belts and the gold coins and the other things, what else was happening around the Exco in that direction?
There were a range of things. Depending on who it was and where they were from, one example was a few of them asked for Australia to give them what is known as honorary consul status, in which case they would be our representative in their area of their country. And that's something, yeah, no football organisation can make a decision on that. It's a decision for government. There were things such as we would pay for the under-20 team from Trinidad and Tobago, Jack Warner's country, to travel to Cyprus for a pre-tournament for the under-20 World Cup in 2009. So it was always about, you know, what can we do to convince this executive committee member that we will do basically whatever it takes to win the bid.
Talking about Jack Warner, later on there was proof that quite an amount ended up on his private account. What was that all about?
Yeah, he sought around about $500,000 from Australia to upgrade a stadium in Trinidad and Tobago, which again is his home country. What no one sort of asked any questions about that. The stadium had been built in the first place with FIFA money that Jack Warner had got through FIFA processes. The land was owned by Jack Warner and his family. But many years later, 3 years later, it was found out that the money that Australia had paid through a bank check that went from Sydney to London to New York to Trinidad and Tobago ended up in Jack Warner's personal bank account.
So it was completely intended, unmarked check, travelling through different countries to end up on his personal account. So it was completely made up?
Well, Australian officials have said subsequently that they didn't know anything, they didn't realise that was going to happen. But that was one of the flawed aspects of the whole bidding process, that on the one hand, you weren't supposed to curry favour with the executive committee members, but that's what most bidders did. No one followed up what happened to that money. Australian officials would say that they had no idea that it was going to Jack Warner's personal bank account. And if we take that as being true, that's one of the flawed processes of the whole bidding process. And that is, you could pay money over, but there was no prudential control on where that money ended up, or whether someone would, as we would say in Australia, clip the ticket on the way through. And that's precisely what happened in this case. On the one hand, ostensibly, the money was paid to upgrade a stadium in Trinidad and Tobago. I would question why we would do that anyway. But putting that aside, the money ended up in Jack Warner's personal bank account.
I mean, Jack Warner was in the ExCo for many, many years, even decades, right? What happened to Jack Warner now?
Jack Warner's banned for life. He has been indicted by the US authorities on a number of counts. He has successfully fought extradition to the United States for many years, and that's where it lays. At this point, you know, he's a man who'd be getting close to 80 or in his 80s now, and he essentially gave up the right to ever see his sons again because they're in the United States. He won't travel to the United States to go under their legal processes. And Trinidad and Tobago continue to give him, I guess, a continuing to help ensure that he doesn't get extradited.
But, of course, Jack Warner was one of the ExCo members who voted. We don't know for who, but definitely was involved in the voting process back in the days.
Yes, he was a voter for the tournaments for 2018 and 2022, and for many of the tournaments before that as well.
There is evidence now that even not only for the vote 2018 and 2022, but going back to the World Cups even before, that many of these ExCo members finally got court cases, allegations and other things. So it looks like these structures and processes were in place not only for this World Cup, not only for Qatar, but for many other World Cups before.
Yeah, they've been in place for quite a long time. And if you look back at the voters, for instance, for 2006 and 2010, both of which were contested World Cup bids, I think it's something like half of the voters in 2006, or a little more than half, have been suspended or banned or indicted. The same with 2010. So it has been this sort of FIFA way of doing business and getting votes, and how that has come about, that has been in place for some time. And, you know, to all credit, the two journalists who first highlighted the issue in relation to Germany 2006, which was a wonderful World Cup. I went to it. It was great. But the two journalists were Jens Weinreich and Thomas Kistner from Germany. And, thanks to their work, there's been a whole lot of people who have come on afterwards who have been able to continue looking at what has happened with those World Cup tournaments.
So if you talk about the FIFA way, what is the FIFA way you are describing?
I would describe it simply as a decision that is not based on merit, a decision where there is no transparency, and a decision where it's basically done on the basis of deals, counter deals, and double deals. If you have a decision based on merit, you don't need all of these ridiculous things such as gifts or asking what you want to vote for us. It is based on merit. It is which country or countries, if it's jointly hosted, can host the best possible tournament for the next iteration of the World Cup.
To have a word about, the long-time president, Mr. Blatter. How did you perceive him, and why did he never got caught? I mean, so far, Mr. Blatter has a clean sheet.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I've said this to Sepp Blatter personally, that at the very least, he has overseen this corruption and he knew it was going on. He also benefited from some of it at times, for instance, when he won some of the presidential elections. So he certainly was willing to turn a blind eye to it if it suited him. I use the phrase in my book, It's whatever, from Sepp Blatter's perspective, he would do whatever it takes to stay in power in FIFA. That was his ultimate objective. So from that perspective, at the very least, he knew what was going on and failed to do something about it. In terms of what type of person he is, I mean, if Sepp Blatter was to walk in now and sit down and have a cup of coffee with you, you could have a lovely conversation about the state of football, the state of the world, and he's a very personable person. He's very easy to talk to, but he's also an ultimate politician. This is the point about the people at the top of FIFA. They are politicians. They have long lost what it's like to be a football player, such as the greats, such as Franz Beckenbauer or Michel Platini, or Angel Maria Villalona, who was also on the executive committee at the time. And they have become football politicians. And unfortunately, just like in ordinary politics, some politicians will do whatever they need to do to stay in power.
Let's talk about Qatar. Mm-hmm. How did they manage to finally pull it off?
They ran a very good bid. That's often overlooked in all of this. They did everything right. They were everywhere. And they had the money to be everywhere. So when they needed to press the flesh, they pressed the flesh. When they needed to impress people, they impressed people. At the end of the day, if you look at those three things which our consultant told us were important that you did right, even though they didn't count, they did all of those things right. And I think they gave the best final presentation. However, they're also very clever. They looked at this not... And they approached the whole World Cup from the very beginning as something for the entire Middle East, not just for Qatar. But they also saw this as part of their nation building and their soft diplomacy and getting Qatar noticed on the world stage. So it was much more to them than hosting a football tournament. It was very much about country branding. And so they approached the whole World Cup bid from a number of different angles. So when, for example, Jerome Valcke told us in July 2009, standing in the foyer of FIFA headquarters, you're not going to win. And we said, why? Because the answer was you won't meet the commercial revenues that the US will. So it was clear FIFA wanted the US to win at that time. I suspect Qatar would have been told exactly the same thing, because the US was the giant of that 2022 bidding contest. And in fact, it was CONCACAF's turn to host it, not Asia's turn. But Qatar, you know, 18, 17 months later, Al Jazeera then went to FIFA and said, well, if you need more revenue, we're offering you more revenue. If you have this tournament in Qatar, we will pay you a production contribution of $100 million extra. When at that time too, remember Emirates used to sponsor FIFA, and the relationship was very much dodgy, on the nose. Emirates wanted out of it, and most airlines knew that. Qatar Airways came and said, we're here and we'll step in and take Emirates' place. So Qatar was very clever from that perspective. They also looked at what would it take to get some key voters changing their vote. And I guess the most high-profile one is Michel Platini and the voters that he took with him, because he had a number of voters in his bloc.
Why is that? I never understood why Platini, if you get Platini's vote, you also get the other votes, and there's a Platini bloc. Why did Platini have a bloc around him?
Well, Platini was a very powerful member of the FIFA executive. At the time, he was the heir apparent to be the president of FIFA. And just as with any sort of political party or political machine, there are natural supporters around particular candidates. So just as Platini had his block of voters, so did Mohammed bin Hamman, so did Jack Warner, so did the people in Africa. So that was just part of the whole political situation of the FIFA executive.
You said that it was the preference, even from Sepp Blatter, and he confirmed it himself, that 2018 goes to Russia, 2022 goes to the United States. How did that change?
The key event was a high-profile meeting which Michel Platini was invited to attend with the then president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the person who is now the emir of Qatar. but he wasn't at the time. And it was, you know, all reports are that that meeting was fundamental in shifting that block of votes that Platini took with him from supporting the US to supporting Qatar.
What was the timing of that meeting? How was it connected to the time when the final voting was taking place?
The meeting took place 10 days before the vote, so it was that close.
I mean, if you look now at 2018 ending up in Russia, 2022 ending up in Qatar, I mean, these political systems obviously have a big advantage also compared to maybe the US, Australia, European candidates, because, I mean, they can coordinate these deals out of one hand. I mean, in Qatar, it's basically the family who then can interfere in these political deals, in the commercial deals and alike. So it's everything can be aligned in all these different levels. That might be a big advantage for them.
It is a huge advantage. So, you know, if you take a country like Australia, on the one hand, we were told we wouldn't win because we couldn't maximise the commercial revenues. Even if we had gone to one of our major companies and said, oh, can you make a $100 million contribution or sponsorship to FIFA, they wouldn't have done it. One, it just wouldn't be the way that we would do business, and we wouldn't have the influence to do it. But two, they just wouldn't have done it. And partly that, in an Australian context, it's because there's a lack of support for football. But also it's because we have a different way of doing business.
And obviously, even if there would be a political will, Australian politicians couldn't go to that company and say, you now have to pay $100 million in Qatar. It's probably possible when the Emir calls, it's clear what needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a very different level of compliance with the leaders of the country. I mean, if the leaders of our country did that, it would be front page news and it would be a scandal. But, you know, in other countries, they have a different way of doing business. They have an absolute ruler and that takes precedence.
So how did the whole bidding process go for you?
It ended prematurely. For which I'm grateful. I was sacked at the end of January 2010, so around about 10 or 11 months before the bid vote. Sorry, I'll need to change that again because that's I got the months wrong. It ended well for me in that I was sacked from my job at the end of January 2010, and that was around about 9 or 10 months before the vote. And that came about because it became too difficult for my boss to have to manage the consultants who were complaining about me all the time and me complaining about them. And when it came to who was more important, they were, because after all, they said they were going to win us the vote.
So at the end, the consultants wanted you to be out?
Yes, they wanted me out of the way.
Why?
It's a question for them. I think they thought that I was going to get in the way of us winning the vote. That's what they went around saying. So they wanted me gone. I think the truth is that I was asking too many difficult questions. I did the right thing. As a senior executive employee, I would go to my boss and my chairman and say, look, why are we doing this? Shouldn't we be doing that? Why are we spending money here? And you didn't ever get answers. And when you don't get answers and, you know, you're working at a senior level in an organisation with a large responsibility for a large amount of funds, it's not appropriate that they're not willing to give answers. So, you know, I always had this feeling that they were a reputational risk, not just for our bid, but for our country.
So you were not turning a blind eye on whatever was going on, but asking questions, and that was too much for them?
Yes, I was asking too many questions and it was too uncomfortable. I guess to borrow from Al Gore, I was terribly inconvenient.
So you were out of the bid and finally decided to whistleblow. What happened afterwards? Which consequences you had to suffer because of stepping out and going against or going public with all these things you know about the processes?
Well, I would say that I started classic whistleblower behaviour when I was still there by asking questions. I did the right thing. I asked questions. Why were we doing this? Shouldn't we be doing something else? What are we doing with these consultants? I asked those questions internally and then got sacked. After a while, when you see things continuing to happen, there comes a time in the life of a whistleblower when your only resort is to the media. And so you start speaking out. And I tried to refrain from speaking to the media for a long time until the vote was over, because I didn't want anyone to say we, Australia, didn't get the bid because she spoke out. I wanted it to play out the way I thought it would play out, so people could see what it was that FIFA was doing. But after that time, and after I sort of received encouragement to speak out from my former boss, I did so and highlighted, from my perspective, I highlighted how a country such as Australia, who most people would think was a pretty good country when it comes to these sorts of things, we were so taken in by the need to win that we would literally do whatever it takes to win. And so if Australia could do that, other countries could do that. And what we were doing, where did that fault lie? The fault lay with FIFA, because it was about how FIFA expected to do business. And I thought they were the issues that needed to be highlighted to football fans around the world. Only 1% of fans, I suspect, actually care about these things. But those of us who do care, care passionately. And we're not dealing with a private company here. We're dealing with a sport which is played by billions around the world and enjoyed by billions around the world. It doesn't belong to anyone. It belongs to all of us. The FIFA executive are mere custodians of the game, and yet they're elected in a fairly undemocratic way. Their decision-making is not transparent, and there was no accountability, and those things needed to be highlighted.
What were your personal consequences? What happened after you were going to the media and speak out?
Well, after I was sacked, I found it very difficult to find a job. When people know that you're a whistleblower, most organisations don't like that. They don't see that as being a benefit. You'd think they would sort of say, oh, good, we've got someone here who's willing to shine a light, but they don't actually do that. And that wasn't helped by the fact that the organisation I had worked for and worked 100 hours a week for quite a few years, then backgrounded media, they denigrated me, they said I was bitter and twisted, I had the consultant saying I was incompetent. All sorts of things were said about me, and it just made it difficult to get on, basically, and to find other work to do.
So what was your personal motivation on a personal level to go public?
It was a couple of things. First of all, I didn't think this is how decisions should be made about important issues such as where a World Cup should be held. I didn't think as a football fan that that's what most football fans expected, what went on. We may have sort of joked about that's what happened and heard stories, but it actually happened, and I thought people needed to know that these decisions were not based on merit. And ultimately, what it was about every little child who plays. You know, if you've been a player, once upon a time you were a little boy who played. I've been a soccer mum and I have had children who played. And who this level of corruption, what Loretta Lynch called the unconscionable level of corruption, fundamentally hurt was every little child who puts on boots or doesn't put on boots, depending on where they come from, who kicks a ball around having a dream about being the best possible player or best possible person they can be. That's why I say the FIFA Executive Committee lost touch with what football was all about.
On top of the maybe expected outcomes or consequences that they were talking bad about you in media and stuff like that, you also had interferences on a different level where you really ask yourself, where does that come from? What was that?
Yeah, I mean, you know that you're truly inconvenient when, you know, you're denigrated in the media, you're demeaned by your ex-colleagues, all of those sorts of things. But I also had surveillance against me. I had my phone was hacked. I had websites that I was responsible for were brought down with a distributed denial of service attack on two occasions. I had fake social media accounts set up in my name. And to this day, I don't have some social media accounts because of that. And it was a next level. And, you know, you had the usual trolling if I appeared on a television program, for example, there would be significant trolling of me. And, you know, as an ordinary person, I'm just a person who grew up in a pretty good country, got educated, had a family and had a career, and I expected to have a pretty ordinary life. And yet you do pay a high price from being a whistleblower.
And now I would like to have one sentence because I read it in the book also, and it's on the right side of history.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, of course, if you continue to be part of the team, even though you maybe don't win the World Cup, but you stay within the Football Federation of Australia, you might have had a big career within Australian football. But now that's over and you have a different path. Why is it still the right thing to do?
It's the right thing to do because it's about who owns football, and we all own football. It doesn't belong to FIFA. It doesn't belong to the executive committee members of FIFA. It doesn't belong to those who run it in any particular country. It is the sport for all of us, however we engage with it. And we deserve to have a sport that is run on the principles and values of fair play and things being based on merit and decisions being made that are transparent and accountable. And at the end of the day, as I see it, would I do it again? Yes, because I'm on the right side of history.
So everybody talks about the alienation of the fans and the developments in football, if it's corruption, commercial developments and all of that. But at the same time, you see the statistics always go up in the stadiums, the watchers in front of the television. I mean, the budgets go up. So where is the alienation everybody talks about? Is it a ghost? Only we in our bubble talk about it, but on a global scale, it's not relevant. Where is the alienation of the football fans?
I think only about 1% of fans are actually interested in these issues and are alienated enough to sort of not purchase kit or something like that. But at the end of the day, too, I think we have a great capacity as human beings to separate bad from good. And so, therefore, we love our football and we love the men and women who play it and love watching it. But we sort of cast aside the football politicians and what we, unfortunately, to some extent become inured to the double dealing that goes on behind some of the commercial issues in the game. So I just think we have that capacity to separate them.
So what about you? Are you watching the World Cup in Qatar this year?
Absolutely, I'll be watching the World Cup in Qatar. The Socceroos, the Australian national team, play France, Denmark and Tunisia. And I expect that we'll get out of the group stage into the second stage.
So at least 3 games you will be in front of the television?
At least 3, 4, and I'd certainly watch the final, whoever's in it.
Thank you very much for your time and the very interesting talk. Thank you very much, Bonita.
That's a pleasure. Thanks, Benjamin.
Vielen Dank, Bonita Merciades, für die spannenden Einblicke, wenn sie auch manchmal ziemlich schmerzhaft sind. Vielen Dank auch an euch da draußen fürs Zuhören. Abonniert gerne diesen Kanal, weil ab sofort gibt's jeden Montag die ganze Weltmeisterschaft über einen Podcast mit spannenden Gästen und interessanten Perspektiven rund um diese skurrile Weltmeisterschaft in Katar. Nächste Woche ist hier Jackson Irvine mit dabei. Er spielt aktuell beim FC St. Pauli und fährt selbst als aktiver Spieler mit der australischen Nationalmannschaft nach Katar zur Weltmeisterschaft. Mit ihm werden wir viele spannende Perspektiven erläutern, vor allem natürlich die Perspektive als aktiver Spieler. Welche Verantwortung kommt den Spielern zu? Inwiefern können sie mit ihrer Aufmerksamkeit etwas Positives bewirken? Und ist es eigentlich fair, von Spielern zu verlangen, dass sie diese Weltmeisterschaft boykottieren sollen? All diese Themen nächste Woche Montag. Schaltet wieder ein und seid mit dabei. Und zu guter Letzt natürlich nochmal ein großes Dankeschön an das ganze Team, Maniac Studios, die Umweltbank und natürlich ProSieben. Ohne euch wäre das Ganze hier nicht möglich. Und zu guter Letzt, zu aller guter Letzt natürlich danke auch an Viva Con Aqua. Jetzt gerade vor Weihnachten, denkt dran, die Projekte von Viva Con Aqua brauchen Unterstützung. In Äthiopien und in Uganda ist die Situation schwierig und deswegen Spenden für Wasser, das macht Sinn. In diesem Sinne, alles Liebe und bis nächste Woche.
Football for Future ist eine Produktion von Viva Con Agua mit freundlicher Unterstützung von der Umweltbank und Maniac Studios.